Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, from high utility bills to delayed SNAP benefits, rural communities were strained in 2025. We speak with Congressman Josh Riley of New York's 19th District, right here in our listening area, about what comes next. With re-election looming, Riley talks to Kimberly Izar about gridlock in Washington and his priorities for the year ahead. High school students from across Sullivan County are honoring Martin Luther King's legacy through service, not just words. We talk with Sullivan 180 about the 5th annual MLK Day of Service Youth Summit. And from the South Bronx to the highest peaks of the Catskills, a solo journey becomes a story of resilience. We talk to filmmaker Jamie Kinnard about his documentary Queen of the Catskills. After the news, from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Residents of Caracas reported heavy gunfire last night just around Venezuela's presidential palace. NPR's Ada Peralta reports it appears to stem from confusion.
On social media, videos from Caracas showed men with rifles trading fire on the streets. From their balconies, residents saw what appeared to be anti-aircraft fire streaking through the air. The government's information ministry told the Spanish news agency EFE that the gunfire was to dissuade drones overflying Miraflores, the presidential palace. The violence surfaced fears that there might be a struggle for power following the U.S. capture of President Nicolas Maduro. But earlier in the day, Venezuela's Vice President Delcy Rodriguez was sworn in as acting president. The Minister of Defense, Vladimir Padrino, also said the Venezuelan Armed Forces are firmly behind Rodriguez. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Cúcuta, Colombia.
President Trump might discuss Venezuela further today. He's meeting with Republican lawmakers this hour at the Kennedy Center in Washington. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports the focus of the meeting is supposed to be on election strategy for the midterm elections.
In the past, when the president has joined these kind of like weekly conference meetings that Republicans have, it almost becomes like a rally. And it's hard not to envision that happening today, given that they're gearing up as a party for the midterm elections. So I think Venezuela will be part of the conversation. I don't think it will be the only topic. And members will have an additional briefing on Venezuela tomorrow.
NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports. Last night, Trump administration officials briefed a handful of top congressional leaders from both parties on the Venezuela situation. Democratic lawmakers have been demanding more answers about President Trump's declaration that the U.S. will run Venezuela. Republicans said last night that their briefing was thorough and their questions were answered. Stocks opened higher this morning as crude oil prices inch upward. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 120 points in early trading.
Crude oil in the U.S. is trading at less than $59 a barrel. That's up slightly from the weekend when U.S. forces seized Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. But prices are still low enough that major oil companies may think twice about making big investments to revitalize Venezuela's long-neglected oil industry. An oil pipeline operator has drawn a record fine for spilling more than 1 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico back in 2023. Regulators say the Third Coast Company allowed oil to keep flowing through a leaky pipeline for hours after gauges signaled a possible problem. And U.S.-based companies have won an exemption from an international tax agreement that would have assessed a 15% minimum corporate tax worldwide. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow has now risen to about 140 points to 49,116. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Food and beverage corporation Nestle is recalling some batches of infant formula it's produced under the name SMA. The company says this recall is due to potential contamination with a toxin. This could trigger nausea and vomiting. Some coastal communities in Northern California are still drying out from weekend flooding. Stormy weather led to many homes and businesses being surrounded by high water north of San Francisco. From member station KQED, Ezra David Romero has more.
A 3-foot-tall line of gray sandbags and blue tarps blocks the entrance of Fitness SF in the Marin County city of Corte Madera. There what mostly stops several feet of water from turning the gym into a pool. Ryan Davis is the gym's general manager.
At least 3 feet of standing water surrounding the entire building, that even with sandbags and plywood and tarps, it was still coming through.
National Weather Service forecasters said the storm outperformed their forecast, resulting in additional storm surge on top of the extra high tides. Marin County officials are still calculating the extent of the damage. For NPR News, I'm Ezra David Romero in Corta Madera.
Officials in the Philippines have raised their alert for the Mayon volcano. The volcano is on the southern part of Luzon Island, hundreds of miles south of Manila, the capital. Filipino officials warned there's an increased chance the volcano could erupt and are warning people to stay away. Researchers say the volcano is one of the most active in the world. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Well, 2025 was undoubtedly a challenging year for many rural New Yorkers. From high utility bills to frozen USDA funding to SNAP benefit delays, Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with 19th Congressional District Representative Josh Riley, a representative for our listening area, on Friday about how those issues shaped his first year in office and what lies ahead in the new year, including the upcoming midterms.
Joining me now to reflect on 2025 and look ahead at 2026 is New York's 19th Congressional District Representative Josh Riley. Congressmember, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And I think, you know, now is kind of that perfect time to do some reflections of the past year, right? So why don't we start off with just some big picture reflections. What has this past year looked like for you, especially as your first year in office?
It's both been just the biggest honor to be able to serve this community and the community that raised me. It's also been really frustrating because I found that Congress is about as broken as I expected it to be. Around here in upstate New York, we care a lot less about people's political parties. We care a lot less about scoring points in politics and who's up and who's down. Around here, most people are really humble, really hardworking, and just want the best for each other. In Washington, it's not really that way. And so one of the things I've really tried to do is bring those upstate New York values with me to Washington. And what that's meant is focus on the things that really make a difference in people's lives and work with anybody who's willing to try to do it. So that's been my focus. I'm really proud of a lot of the legislation and initiatives we've been able to move as a result of that. But it really is like two different worlds between upstate New York's values and the corruption in the swamp in Washington.
Yeah, I know you talked about just the political machine that operates when you step into Washington. Are there any lessons that you think you're kind of going to bring into 2026 that you learned from the past year?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's basically, since I got into politics, it's kind of confirmed for me what I expected and how I think this whole thing is set up. I'll give you one example. I talk to folks all across the community every day. And one of the things I've been hearing about the most from folks is that they're just getting crushed with the utility bills. And the bills are going up and it's making it so much harder for folks to make ends meet, whether that's the volunteer firefighters in Delaware County that I sat down with who have to cut back on the equipment they need to be able to afford the bills, a public school teacher in Tompkins County who's worried about losing her home and had to pick up a second job. And meanwhile, while folks are struggling really hard around here, you have NYSEG and Central Hudson and National Grid owned by foreign corporations that are reporting hundreds of millions of dollars in profits at our expense. And when I look at that, I see a system that is completely rigged against hardworking folks in upstate New York and rigged in favor of these big foreign corporations. And the reason the economy is rigged like that is because our politics are also broken. Those same corporations, NYSEG, Central Hudson, their parent corporations, They're pumping tons of corporate PAC money into the system. They're hiring lobbyists. And so one of my big fights has been and is going to continue to be to clean up all that corruption, because that is needed to make life more affordable for folks. It means banning corporate PAC money, imposing term limits, stopping the insider trading in Congress.
Probably the biggest change that I think Americans saw last year was President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, which was signed into law in July, which you were a sharp critic of the spending bill. You voted against it. Tell me a little bit more about how this spending bill shaped 2025 for New Yorkers.
Yeah, that bill is so bad for upstate New York. It is so bad for our rural communities. And it's literally just look at the numbers. It is cutting $1 trillion out of the public health system over the next 10 years, $1 trillion taken out of rural hospitals across the Catskills and the Hudson Valley that are already hanging on by a thread, $1 trillion out of nutrition assistance and health care for families who are already making tough choices between paying the utility bills, paying the health insurance premiums, paying the mortgage. And then you're going to take $1 trillion away from them. And as if that wasn't bad enough, they took that $1 trillion and they handed it off to the top 1% and a bunch of people who are pushing paper around Wall Street who frankly don't need $1 trillion in tax breaks right now. And so you look at our community, you look at this congressional district, over a third of the folks here are on Medicaid, 40% of the kids, half the babies, 70% of the seniors in assisted living facilities. And they're getting screwed by this bill so that a bunch of folks at the top with their lobbyists and their corporate PAC slush funds can get more. And I want to say this too, like this is a massive bill and this is what's wrong with Washington. Because there are a handful of things in this bill that we might have been able to work together on a bipartisan basis. For example, I don't think there should be a tax on Social Security benefits. I have legislation. It's called You Earned It, You Keep It. It would say we're not going to tax Social Security benefits anymore. There's a whole bunch of folks on the other side of the aisle who at least say they support that. Let's set that aside. Let's work together. Let's find common ground on that issue and do it. But instead, they bundled up this massive package that is a gut punch to rural America. It's a gut punch to folks who are already working hard across upstate New York. And it's the same old story of corruption where all that money is going to benefit folks who are already doing really well.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we're going to be seeing over the next few months is that as of actually just yesterday, as of January 1st, the ACA subsidies expired. Millions of Americans are going to likely see those insurance premiums increase or possibly lose healthcare coverage entirely. I'm curious just how, as you look ahead into 2026, how is your office preparing for these new challenges?
Yeah, there's a couple of things with this. I mean, first of all, this is like the perfect example of how broken and corrupt and stupid Congress is. I mean, if we had a vote tomorrow, which hopefully we will actually next week, at least in the House, if we had a vote to extend the ACA subsidies for at least a year or two while we figure out a bigger fix to this, I bet it would get 250, 300 votes because most people have enough common sense to know that we shouldn't allow healthcare premiums to spike on folks overnight. This is especially challenging for folks across upstate New York because the people who are going to see their premiums spike tend to be small business owners, family farmers. And we should be helping those folks in these really challenging times, and allowing those ACA subsidies to expire is just making things harder for them. And there's no reason for it. That's why I got together with a bipartisan coalition of about 30, 35 folks who said, look, we're going to set aside the politics on this. We don't care who is like the winner and the loser inside the beltway with the punditry and the political elite. We need to make sure that the folks we're representing aren't being pushed off a cliff with the expiration of these ACA subsidies. So my hope is that when we get back down to Washington next week, we're able to get a vote on that, that it passes overwhelmingly and forces the hand in the Senate. And then the last thing I'll say on this, and I'll say this is probably the thing that I'm most proud of from the last year. When I got into office, I said, look, You know, where I'm a freshman, I'm in the minority. I'm going to be as aggressive and creative as possible in terms of getting things done. The one thing that is fully within our control is our constituent services operation. And I'm really proud of the operation we've built. We've done, I think, 60 or more mobile office hours all across the district. We have two offices open and a third coming online in the Catskills soon. And we've helped hundreds and hundreds of folks with their cases. And so whether it's a health insurance issue or any other issue, folks should really come to our office.
I also think that when it comes to healthcare, even before this spending bill, rural hospitals in rural communities have been struggling for a very long time. Shortage of healthcare providers, tough financial constraints. I'd love to just hear a little bit more about some of the other healthcare legislation you either introduced, co-sponsored this past year.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, the healthcare system across the country is completely broken. In rural America, it's borderline in shambles. And you look at the rural hospitals across this region and how much they're struggling. So a couple of things that I've been working on. Number one, you mentioned it, we need to improve the pipeline of doctors and nurses and providers in rural communities. And so I have legislation that would create incentives and bonuses for folks who will come and work in rural communities for some period of time. I'm also leading a bill called the Rural Hospital Stabilization Act, working on that. It's bipartisan with folks from rural communities across the country who know that the cuts from the One Big Beautiful Bill are going to be so devastating across rural America. And then one other piece of this is I've really been focused on just hyper-local efforts for our providers here. I was really proud to secure hundreds of thousands of dollars in funding for the hospital in Margaretville. It'll allow it to completely transform its primary care operations. I was able to deliver about $1 million to Refua Health Center in Sullivan County. We're going to have announcements for a handful of other significant investments that are coming directly home to our rural hospitals to try to mitigate some of the damage that was caused by the one big, I call it the one big ugly bill.
Representative, just a few other issues that was in the spotlight in 2025. Let's talk a little bit about some of the pushback. You know, you've faced here in Sullivan, SUNY Sullivan in October. There have been several protests at your events over your stance on the war in Gaza. As Israel's war in Gaza is now in its third year, more than 70,000 Palestinians have died. What do you have to say to constituents who feel Congress isn't doing enough to end the war?
Yeah, look, this congressional district, it's about a third Democrats, a third Republicans, a third Independents. I represent folks in 170 towns across 11 counties, and people are going to disagree with each other. And that's not only okay, it's to be expected. It's part of a healthy, functioning democracy. I think people know this about me. I'm a Democrat. I come from a Republican family. Most of the block where I grew up voted for President Trump and voted for me. I come from a place and approach this job from a place of disagreements, even strong disagreements are, that's part of democracy. And so, what I would say is I want everybody to know I hear you and I take all different perspectives into account. I think with respect to this particular issue, emotions are running high and rightfully so. It's impossible to turn on the TV and see the images coming out of the Middle East and not be just absolutely heartbroken. And so I want the violence to end. I was one of the first folks to actually push for a ceasefire. I had the opportunity to go to Israel for a few days last August and see for myself on the ground what the situation was, get some intelligence assessments, had an opportunity to meet with folks in the United Nations who are responsible for food distribution and ask them directly, what do you need to be able to do this effectively? When I got home, led the effort to open humanitarian visas so that kids in Gaza who need medical attention could come to the United States for it. And so I think I'm where most people in our district are. Our folks, you know, want to see peace in the region. They want to see the Israelis and the Palestinians be able to live side by side in peace. And, you know, everything I'm doing on that issue is toward that end.
Another group of constituents that we heard from quite often in 2025 were farmers. They have faced a devastating year, frozen USDA funding, high tariffs, immigration raids. What steps have you taken in Congress to address some of these challenges facing farmers, especially at the local level?
Yeah, and that's really where it starts. I've spent so much time with our farmers across the region, whether it's, you know, specialty crops like our apple growers or the hundreds of dairy farms that we have across this region. I convened an agriculture advisory board, and I always start from the point of, how can I be helpful to you? What are the challenges you're facing? What are the things that keep you up at night? Because those are the things that I want to be working on. One of the things that happened very early during the Trump administration, when Elon Musk came in with his chainsaw and all the like nonsense with that, they ended up canceling contracts that had been entered into with farmers across the country, and dozens, if not about 100, across upstate New York, where the government had basically gotten into contracts with farmers so that the farmers would do conservation practices that otherwise would have been way too expensive. So, for example, a farmer might have a contract with the federal government where the government would split the cost of planting cover crops, which is, you know, obviously great for the soil, but something that any one farmer probably couldn't afford on their own. Manure ponds being built and splitting the cost between the federal government and the farmers. And when Trump came in and Elon Musk came in, they canceled all those contracts. And so my office started getting calls from farmers across the district saying, hey, I had invested a bunch of money and the rug just got pulled out from under me. And so we stepped in. I introduced legislation called the Honor Farmer Contracts Act and pressed the administration to reinstate these contracts. We ended up getting that done. I got the Secretary of Agriculture under oath in the Agriculture Committee committing to me that all of the contracts for the farmers that I represent had been reinstated. And that made a big, that was a big deal, because it in some cases could have meant the difference between keeping or losing the farm. One other example I'll give you, I was having, I had a meeting with the superintendent of a really rural school district in Delaware County. I don't know, probably beginning of the year. And he was telling me about how proud he was of their program where they source all of their food for the school meals from the local farms. It's actually harder to do that than it is because of the, how broken our food system is. Folks will, you know, be able to ship processed food halfway across the country. And it's been set up that that's actually easier and cheaper in a lot of ways. But this school district had built its supply so that it was sourcing everything from the local farms. And so I told him, I said, I want to come in and have lunch with the kids and then go out and visit, visit the farms. And he said, no, Josh, those are all, like, that's the point, is these are all the same people. The kids are eating the food that their families are growing. The Trump administration came in and canceled hundreds of millions of dollars that supported this effort, the farm to school program. And so I've led the effort in a bipartisan way with Democrats and Republicans on legislation to reinstate that funding so that those schools can continue to buy locally. That's a huge deal for farmers. It's a huge deal for the schools. Just a couple of weeks ago, we passed the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act, which was one of the first bills I sponsored when I got to Congress. It makes sense for kids because whole milk is the most nutritious. It's also really good for our dairy farmers who are going to be able to start selling their milk to schools again. So that's just a handful. There's a long, long list of things, but that's hopefully gives you a sense of the work we're doing.
No, absolutely. And I think with the USDA funding that got pulled back at the start of last year, I think some folks don't realize that this was funding or contracts that were guaranteed to farmers that farmers actually had already spent their money on and was essentially just waiting for reimbursement.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I remember one of the calls we got was from a gentleman who, you know, I'm pretty sure he voted for President Trump three times. I'm almost certain he voted against me twice. And he called shortly after I got into office and said, you know, he was out tens of thousands of dollars because the government had made a promise to him. And I remember in that moment just thinking, this is an opportunity to show that we as a community in upstate New York will always set aside the political differences to do what's right for each other. And I told my team, I was like, we are going to make it our life's mission to get these contracts reinstated for this farmer and for every other farmer across upstate New York who's being screwed over by the federal government. And we worked really hard to get it done. And like I said, we have we had, when Brooke Rollins, the Secretary of Agriculture, came to testify, we had been working with the department in advance of that. And by the time she came in, we were able to confirm that all of our farmers' contracts had gotten reinstated.
Wow. Let's look ahead at 2026 a bit. This is going to be a big year for the district. You're up for a re-election with the midterms this November. New York State Senator Peter Oberrock announced that he will be running against you. What is top of mind for you going into this election?
It's going to be the same thing that's been top of mind for me since I got into politics, which is just, you know, listening to folks across the community. Always ask, never, you know, the question for me is never, are you a Democrat or Republican? It's what's keeping you up at night and what are you hopeful for? And then trying to take that with me to Washington. I think we have some really some legislation that I'm working on that I think has a really good shot of moving in the new year, including a bipartisan bill that I just introduced to crack down on fentanyl trafficking. That's been a huge issue, especially, you know, in Sullivan County with the corrections officers I've heard from, so many families who have lost loved ones. I have bipartisan legislation I'm working on that I think we're also going to be able to move this year to improve the pipeline of STEM teachers in our rural communities. So for me, it's really just about continuing to focus on doing the work, and the politics will take care of itself.
Congressmember, before we sign off, just anything else you want to share as we move into this new year?
Yeah, I mean, I think the last thing I just say is how I'm so grateful for the opportunity to do this. I've had folks sometimes, especially over the holidays, you know, you spend a lot of time out in the community with my family, and folks will ask, you know, you see what's happening in Washington on TV, and people will ask, like, how bad is it? And my honest answer to it is I think, like, the bigger the challenges are, the more grateful I am to be in this position where I can fight for our community in a time where our politics are really broken, trying to bring people together. You know, looking back at, we talked about the one big ugly bill, and being able to give a voice to the folks across our district who are really struggling, and to be able to, you know, say what that would mean to them, being in a position to be in those fights, I think is something I'm really grateful for. I don't take it for granted at all.
I've been chatting with New York's 19th Congressional District Representative Josh Riley. Looking back at 2025 and what work lies ahead in 2026, Congressmember, thank you again for joining us and for this half hour together.
Happy to do it. Looking forward to the next one. Happy New Year to everybody. And just one last reminder, anybody who needs help with constituent services, call our office. We're here for you.
Thanks to Kimberly Izar for that report. We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll speak to the folks at the Center for Discovery and Sullivan 180 about leadership, service, and purpose all through the eyes of local teens. It's the MLK Day of Service Youth Summit coming up this week. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, I'm Kusar Grace KG, host of the Music Emporium. 2 hours of great music right here on Radio Catskill. Sometimes I start out with a little bit of talk concerning things in the world for the week. Then I jump into some tunes that you will enjoy. Jazz, funk, blues, and more. So come and hang out with me. The Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill.
Sullivan County has 2 warming centers that are open to all every night this winter. The Liberty Shelter is located at the United Methodist Church on North Main Street, and the Monticello Shelter is located at St. John's Episcopal Church on St. John Street. These shelters are open for anyone from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. More information at sullivanny.us. And keep listening for winter weather updates on Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejayville.com.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is observed later this month on January 19th, but here in Sullivan County, the work of honoring Dr. King's legacy is already underway. Students from across the county are coming together for the 5th annual MLK Day of Service Youth Summit later this week, an event held in spirit of Dr. King's call to service, leadership, and community, even ahead of the official holiday. Hosted at SUNY Sullivan, the summit brings together 11th and 12th graders for a day of reflection, workshops, and connection focused on helping young people see themselves as leaders and change makers. Joining us now is Amanda Langsater of Sullivan 180, Cami Walter and Amanda Ward from the Center for Discovery, the presenting sponsor of the Youth Summit, to talk about how it all began and what students can experience during the day. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Amanda, we've talked about this before. It's the 5th annual MLK Day of Service Youth Summit. Talk about how it all got started and the original vision and where we are now.
Yeah, this is crazy to me to be preparing for the 5th MLK Day of Service Youth Summit. It really just doesn't seem possible. We're talking about 6 years ago, youth serving organizations from across the county and lots of county government departments came together around a startling statistic, our high rate of disconnected youth here in the county. And those of us that work with youth became upset, like, how can this be? How can youth not feel like they have a sense of community and organizations and people that care about them? So we came together, had a long conversation about what we could do, how we could respond, and how could we give young people just preparing for, you know, for takeoff in life, a community hug, a community embrace, so they know that these organizations are here for them, whether it be workforce development. The Boys and Girls Club was at the table. The Youth Bureau was at the table. Cornell Cooperative Extension. I could go on and on about the number of organizations that sat at that first table and said, what is it that we can do to change this situation, change this rate of disconnected youth, and connect young people to their community and to the idea of community service in the name of Martin Luther King Jr.
So 5 years is a milestone. So tend to look back on those kinds of milestone anniversaries. What have you learned and what have you seen, and how's that hug going?
Oh, my goodness. So, you know, my favorite part is sometimes walking in the grocery store in my MLK sweatshirt and somebody will come up to me and go, hey, did you go to that thing? And I'm like, yeah, I was there. And hey, were you there? And did you meet somebody? Did you connect with somebody in your community? Oh, my gosh, I want to go back to that summit. And that makes me feel like a ball of fire. But really, the collective impact of multiple organizations, no one of our organizations could have possibly pulled off for 5 years strong a Martin Luther King Day of Service Youth Summit. In a little bit, I'll mention some more of those organizations, but that's what it's all about. And it's all about connecting with organizations like the Center for Discovery that see value in ensuring that our young people in this community here know that we're here for them.
Talk us through a typical day for a student that comes to this day. It's Friday, January 9th. How is this different from a typical school day or a classroom lesson or assembly? What do folks experience? What do kids experience?
It's way different. You arrive at the Youth Summit on the campus of SUNY Sullivan, and instantly you're elevated and treated like the young adult that you are on the campus. We're excited to have them there. They get treated to an incredible keynote. Our keynote this year is Dr. John Gaines, who is going to really blow the students away with his message of how he found his sense of somebodyness. That's in the words of MLK. And then they experience that incredible keynote speaker. They break up into workshops across the college campus where they are meeting folks from different organizations across Sullivan County, adults that are there with them to lead them through an MLK quote workshop. And they dive really deep into the incredible words of Dr.
The words.
Luther King.
When you say quote workshop, you mean, you're not saying air quotes workshop. You're saying his quotes.
No, yeah,
his words.
His words, MLK said, if you can't fly, then run. If you can't run, then walk. If you can't walk, then crawl. But whatever, you just keep moving. And that's those words that just stick with somebody when they're feeling like all they can do is barely crawl. And yet they're going to keep pushing themselves. Those words that Dr. Martin Luther King spoke, whether it was 1959 or now 2026, sorry, they are still just as important for young people to hear. And when we play that Blueprint for Life speech in the theater, not a pin drop. I mean, there is just, you can't hear anything but silence, and the students so tuned in to that grainy black and white footage of Dr. Martin Luther King, but his words just, they're riveting and they still ring true to everyone today.
Cami and Amanda are nodding their heads that electricity that you feel in that room. Talk a little bit about what you guys have experienced as presenting sponsors of this event and why it's important for the Center for Discovery to be involved in this day of service.
So I think, you know, both Cammie and I can agree that when you have such a unique community like ours, when you have, you know, more people who are involved, your impact is stronger. And so we recognize that we're the largest employer in Sullivan County with 1,800, you know, staff, and many of these students' parents work for us, and they might work for us, or they're looking for internships with us. And so for us to be able to be a part of this, we recognize that we are walking alongside these students, and we're learning from them, and we're also giving them a voice, and we're also, you know, hoping to inspire them so that they realize how many opportunities there are that are out there that they can be involved in.
Yeah, absolutely. We attend a lot of, you know, career fairs at the schools. So it's great to be able to see some of the students and recognize them again for the second time, whether it just be us seeing them for the second time because we were at their school the first time, and making that community impact and making that connection with them.
I wanted to talk about one of the quotes that we were talking about, his words. One of the ideas that he spoke about, service purpose, helping young people develop their, quote, sense of somebodiness. Talk a little bit about that and how this summit brings that to life through either activities or workshops or whatever things that students would be experiencing during this Youth Summit day.
Absolutely. You know, that sense of somebodiness, I think all of us can think back over our lives and remember spots in life where we couldn't find our sense of somebodiness. We were a little lost. We were trying to figure it all out. And if you are 17, 18 years old, preparing for high school graduation, trying to figure out your own sense of somebodiness, an event like this comes along and reminds you that it's okay. It's okay to struggle in that pursuit of your sense of purpose, your sense of somebodiness, and that actually you have organizations all around you and volunteer opportunities all around you that will help you find that sense of somebodiness. It can be a game changer. We've had kids actually who have met somebody from the radio station at the MLK Day of Service, gone and done an internship at a radio station, and gone on to radio careers after that. We've had students who have met folks from volunteer firefighting service agencies and have gone on to become volunteer firefighters. And so there's so much great opportunity because of the community partners that are there. And that all those partners are giving, just like the Center for Discovery is giving. We have the Youth Bureau that gave a tremendous grant so that we could bring in Dr. Gaines for additional presentations at RJK, Monticello Middle School, and Liberty Middle School. We also have Action Toward Independence that's giving a copy of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The King, to every single student at the summit. So every student's walking away with not just hearing the words and understanding who Dr. Martin Luther King is, but really a book to further understand his legacy and the lasting impact that he made.
Amanda, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I also want to add, I think, you know, being a part of the facilitation and working with the students in the past and seeing them being able to develop connections with, you know, adults and with other peers and network. And I think in those moments, recognizing that this is also like an incubator for developing those skills where you usually don't develop those until you go to like college or something along those lines, but you're offering that opportunity in that setting in a college environment. I mean, that is just so kinetic. You feel the inspiration happening. You feel the energy. And it also, in a way, inspires you as an adult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to mention that we have several students from the My Brother's Keepers program, both in Monticello and Fallsburg, that are speaking and presenting, emceeing the day. They are our musicians. I mean, these are student leaders that step up to the plate. I sit back on Friday. I'm sitting back in the front row and watching the action because these student leaders step up and really take leadership of the summit and make it a success.
Cammie, I get the sense that, of course, the financial contribution as a presenting sponsor, the Center for Discovery is important, but coming back to this event is much more than that. It's about opening these doors of possibility for these students. Is that what keeps you coming back?
Yeah, absolutely. The center is always giving out. We're doing tours. We have Monticello School, Liberty School that come for tours. We're going to Single Bite. So the center is really, you know, encompassed in the community also.
Amanda Alexander from Sullivan 180, as this day approaches, which Friday, and I know there's been a lot of work going into it. What do you hope students take away from this when the day ends? Is it that you know, you talked about the connections with people they meet and maybe going on to further a career in that place. But are there other like senses that you want them to sort of take away with them or hope they take away with them?
Of course, the greater message is that Martin Luther King Day is a day of service. It's not a day, just a day off. It's a day of service. And so we're really hoping that they walk away from Friday with an idea, a seed of an idea for their school community of a service project that they want to work on. And it might be their school food pantry. It could be a school campus cleanup. Who knows what it might be that they're going to work on back on their own school campus. And it just always amazes me how young people who give back, who provide community service, they start to find that sense of purpose, that sense of somebodiness through that service. So I think, if anything, I just hope that every student walks out, even if they're not totally bought in, but they're like, you know what, I'm willing to help out my friends, and let's do this project back at that. The campus, they might just get that little seed of, oh boy, I want to do this some more.
Can you give an example of something that's happened over the last 4 or 5 years of a student or organizations that did take that back and did see it more than just a day off?
yeah, definitely. Well, I think the biggest one probably is the school food pantries. We're really proud of a lot of the schools that have taken the time to make sure that food insecurity is not an issue for their students or their staff. And they've developed out a pantry, and that pantry also could include personal care items. It's not always easy for people to have the hygiene supplies that they need. And when you're a student, to be able to know you can go to some place in the building confidentially and get what you need, that's huge. So I would say those are the best examples, but the best is yet to come, because we're going to be much more intentional this year about all of us as agencies going out to support the schools with those projects after the summit.
Amanda, Cammie, excuse me, why do you think it's important for young people across Sullivan County specifically to see themselves as leaders, as change makers?
Oh my gosh. I mean, they're going to be taking care of us one day. That's why. I mean, quite honestly, Cammie and I both have kids who are in high school. And so I truly mean that. Like, I hope that Cammie's son or my daughter, they're hiring us one day or they're caring for us and, in the healthcare setting. And I think that is why it's important, because we're not going to be here forever. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's our responsibility and our job to inspire those young folks to be leaders, because they're going to be running the show when we're not here.
Cammie, anything to add?
Agreed. They're the next leaders of our county, our country.
Yeah.
We've got to develop them.
Now, this is focused on youth. It's already underway. People have registered. But if folks want to learn more or get involved, where can they go and get more information?
Absolutely. They're welcome to go to Sullivan180.org. We certainly have all the information right there. And they're welcome to reach out to any of our partners. We have so many great planning partners. Of course, the Center, of course, the Youth Bureau. I mentioned Action Toward Independence, Cornell Cooperative Extension, Workforce Development, Public Health. I could go on and on. I'm going to miss organizations for sure, but they're going to be there on Friday. So, just reach out and find out more if you want to get involved. The NAACP is also going to be joining us on Friday. I could go on and on, because people are just showing up in force on Friday to be there for the young people in our community. That's what we do here in Sullivan County. We rally around our youth and we bring them whatever we can to make sure that they have what they need here.
Amanda, Cammie, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can share that Sullivan 180 and this event has inspired us so much as an organization that we have literally chomped at the bits to be even more involved. And that's a testament to our involvement this year. And the sky is the limit for future years. So I want to say that.
Thank you. I'll remember that, Amanda.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I'll send you the clip later.
Yes. And I also want to share that we wanted to keep the momentum. And so we're going to be able to invite the students and teachers to come to the center. We're going to have a recruitment event on January 14th. That's going to be open, like an open house. And so we want to continue that momentum of the doors of opportunity and that theme. And so we're going to be offering that, and we're excited. And that'll be held at the Center for Discovery.
That's a great through line because, as you mentioned at the beginning, one of or the largest employer in Sullivan County.
Yes.
And to show these students who will be taking care of us later on that there are these opportunities right here, and especially something with so great as the Center for Discovery. Thank you guys all for being here. Cammie Walter, Amanda Ward from the Center for Discovery, and Amanda Langsater from Sullivan 180. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate this.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, a new documentary, Queen of the Catskills. After a series of traumatic events, a South Bronx high school teacher retreats to the hills of the Catskills and sets out to become the first woman to backcountry ski 33 of the region's highest peaks alone. The filmmaker behind the documentary joins us next. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, with a new year coming, are you ready for a fresh start?
You can take the opportunity to reflect upon the way you've always done things.
And what does it take to reset bad habits?
I actually think the most successful people use all these tricks.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
On the next Radiolab.
This is going to get weird down to the fabric.
ChatGPT-3.
GPT-4.
Everything Apple Intelligence.
These systems don't have the common sense of a mouse.
What would an AI autopsy show us about how they think?
AI cannot suffer and rejoice in the same way that humans can.
That's a good way of looking at AI. Profoundly alien.
That's on the next Radiolab. Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring deli sandwiches, gourmet specials, and catering. TheNeversinkGeneralStore.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Catskills have long been a proving ground for East Coast skiing, and a documentary, Queen of the Catskills, tells the story through one woman's deeply personal journey. The film centers on Julie McGuire, a South Bronx high school English teacher who turns to the mountains after a series of traumatic events disrupt her life. What begins as a search for healing becomes a multi-year quest as McGuire rediscovers her love of skiing and sets out to become the first woman to backcountry ski 33 of the Catskills' highest peaks entirely alone. The film is directed by Jamie Kinnard, and he's bringing Queen of the Catskills to the region this month with a series of special screenings in Hunter, North Adams, and Rosendale, and he joins us now. Jamie, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So for listeners just hearing about it, how do you describe Queen of the Catskills? How did Julie's story first come to your attention?
Well, I am a backcountry skier myself, and I was sort of, you know, I keep a pulse on what's happening in the region. And back in 2022, I noticed through social media that Julie was starting to ski the high peaks. And though I didn't know her at the time personally, we sort of struck up an online friendship. And then I reached out with my interest about following her around and starting to document her journey.
And as I mentioned, she's not a professional athlete. She's a teacher, a city resident, someone who's looking to heal. Why was it important for you to tell this story through her experience?
Well, the healing part of the film wasn't something that I was aware of to start. You know, when I first heard about Julie and what she was doing, I just wanted to go out and make a film about a woman and a person that was backcountry skiing in the Catskills, because I know through my own personal experience as a backcountry skier, it's a very difficult thing. And so really, getting to know sort of the why of Julie's journey is something that came out during the process of making the film. And, you know, I started the film in 2022 and finished it last winter. So it was really sort of 3-4 years of following Julie into the mountains and also just getting to know her as a person, where I realized that there's this whole other reason why she was sort of compelled to spend so much time up here and to do this thing and to do it alone.
The film follows her after a series of traumatic events. How do you, as a filmmaker then, as you said, not really knowing that much about it going into it, how do you then approach telling this story without turning it into, you know, spectacle movie kind of thing?
Yeah. You know, during one of the first sit-down interviews I did with Julie, at the very end of the interview, I was done with my questioning and I asked if there was anything I hadn't asked her about. And she had a long pause and then she decided on her own to share some stories with me. And, you know, that sort of opened it up to, you know, telling a different version of what this movie could be. And, you know, when I sat down to edit it this summer, I decided to include some of the things that she had shared with me, hoping that she was willing to let those stories be shared with a larger audience. And she was open to that. And actually, you know, it really has changed the trajectory of what the movie was about. And I think for me as a filmmaker, it really made it such a more meaningful piece of work than what I had expected to make when I first started out 4 years ago.
What can you share for listeners about the things that she shared with you in terms of some of these events that shaped her and then also then, of course, shaped this documentary?
Julie, I think there are things in her life, having to do with domestic abuse. And, you know, Julie was not much of a skier growing up. And so some of her traumatic experiences that she went through as an adult, as a sort of young adult in her 20s, really sort of compelled and pushed her to get back out into the outdoors and to sort of embrace what she could do and accomplish in the outdoors. And, I think she would rather have not gone through those things, but she's used her experience and what she went through and has really sort of turned it around and flipped it on its head and used it to sort of propel her. And, you know, as Julie likes to say, it's just, you know, what she's doing now is just the universe sort of, you know, speaking to her, and, you know, she sort of follows what the universe says. And that really is kind of like a guiding light post for her to get out and do these things and to really feel accomplished. She's really channeled it into something special. And I think a lot of people have taken a lot from that have seen the film.
Her goal of backcountry skiing 33 Catskill Peaks alone is physically demanding. It's emotionally isolating. What did you learn about Julie during these quiet moments on this journey?
She is, you know, she is just, even though there are quiet moments, and I knew as a filmmaker, this was a personal sort of solo journey for her. And so when we were out there together, I probably filmed 7 or 8 peaks with her. I made a point to sort of keep a distance. And though we did converse from time to time, I really wanted to let her have that solo kind of experience. And I didn't want to sort of intrude on what she was experiencing out there. And of course, it's a little bit different when you do have a person sort of trailing behind. Mm. But, you know, she's very methodical. She's driven. She's thoughtful. And she's a powerhouse out there in the mountains. And to just watch someone just trudge through, break trail, because often we're out there after snowstorms have hit. And so nobody's broken trail. Sometimes there's 2 or 3 feet of snow and it's just physically demanding. And she's just so sort of quietly driven and methodical. And I don't know, it was a real pleasure to watch someone just sort of toil away and really embrace the hard work out there. But to see that she comes back from these outings, which are very long, some of them are 8, 9, 10, 12 hours in the mountains, and just to watch her come back and just see sort of a smile on her face, and just to see the accomplishment and to kind of know what it means to her to have done that thing.
This is a solo quest for her, but the Catskill skiing community plays a role too. How did that community shape the story you're telling?
Well, it's a small but growing community. You know, in other areas of the Northeast and certainly out Western Europe, backcountry skiing is a much larger thing. But people are supportive. I think Julie inspired some other folks who have since gone on to ski the Catskills or are pursuing it now. So people were certainly tuned into what she was doing, and there are more people out there now who are sort of chasing that similar path that she chased. And, Julie, not only was she the first woman, she was only the third person to do it ever, which is a huge accomplishment. And she is not stopping there. She is continuing to ski more high peaks here in the Catskills with the goal of being the first person to ski the 100 highest mountains here in the Catskills. Wow. And she's been hard at work this winter. I think at this point she might be halfway through that goal. So it's exciting to see her from a distance continue to do that. And though I'm not out there filming the peaks this winter, she's continuing to chip away at them.
I want to ask you about filming during the winter time over multiple years off the beaten path. What were some of the biggest challenges documenting this story for you?
Well, a big one, and it's highlighted in the film, but we went out last November. We got a couple early snowstorms here, and Julie had a few peaks left. And we went out after a big snowstorm, and just, you know, she and I'm on snowshoes while I'm filming, and she's on skis, and we're both essentially breaking trail. And just to be out there breaking trail and, you know, going through equipment malfunctions and snows, you know, falling off the trees onto camera equipment, and we're, you know, out there in the dark, the sun's going down, and you get exhausted, you get depleted, things start going wrong, either with ski bindings or camera equipment or snowshoes. And, you know, to have an equipment malfunction when you're 5 or 6 or 7 miles out there, you know, if you don't have your skis or your snowshoes working under your feet, and then you're suddenly having to trudge back, you know, just with ski boots on through waist deep snow, that can be a real dangerous situation. So things got a little tenuous, but we managed to figure stuff out, get things fixed, and, you know, we always made it back to the car, even if we were totally exhausted and depleted.
You've been screening the documentary across the country, also up in British Columbia. Most recently, I think, in Alaska in December. You'll be in Idaho on Friday, but you're coming back coming back east on the 15th in Hunter, screening at the Catskill Mountain Foundation's Mountain Cinema, then in North Adams, Mass on the 24th at Mass Mocha, and then on the 29th in at Rosendale Theater. You're also screening the documentary at each of these East Coast screenings with a different short film. Can you just tell us briefly about each of those pairings?
Yeah, of course. Hunter, New York, we're screening with Kingston, New York's Ian McGrew. He's an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, and he made a short film called Reviving the Legend. It's about Hickory Ski Center up in Warrensburg, which is southern Adirondacks, and it was a ski center that was sort of fighting for its life to remain open, and just about how the community jumped in to help revive it. North Adams, over at Mass Mocha, we're screening with a film called Still Excited to Ski. Noah Dines, he's a Vermont native. In 2024, he broke the uphill ski world record. So he skied uphill 3.5 million feet over the course of a year, which is just, it's like skiing 10,000 vertical feet, like climbing 10,000 vertical feet a day, practically. It's really incredible. Short documentary with him. And then on the 29th in Rosendale, this is the only time this has ever happened, I made another short documentary film called Variable about the 10 years that my brother and I spent backcountry skiing the Adirondack 46ers. My brother and I were the second people to have ever skied that mountain range. So we're screening Variable and Queen of the Catskills together at Rosendale Theater on Thursday the 29th.
Amazing. Where can folks get more information about these upcoming screenings and the documentary?
They can find everything at queenofthecatskillsmovie.com. All of the show links, the trailer to the film, and more are at queenofthecatskillsmovie.com.
And what do you hope folks take away from them after the credits roll on this film? You know, it's about healing, it's about persistence, it's about finding purpose. What do you want audiences to take away?
Yeah, I think just to be inspired. And I think to, I was certainly inspired by how Julie turned around a really tough part of her life that, you know, encompassed many years, and really, her life could have gone in a totally different direction. And she really channeled it in and, turned it into something that she's super passionate about. And she's, she's really wonderful in sharing that passion, and has inspired a lot of other people to get out, not just to backcountry ski, but just to get out into the mountains and to really appreciate what it can do for us.
That's Jamie Kinnard, director of Queen of the Catskills. It's coming this month to screenings in Hunter, North Adams, and Rosendale. And you can find out more at queenofthecatskills.com. Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Well, that'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. A winter weather advisory is in effect for our listening area from 4 this afternoon through 11 tomorrow morning. A mix of freezing rain and rain develops later today. The mix is expected to change back to wet snow overnight. Ice accumulations up to a tenth of an inch, along with up to a half an inch of snow. Use caution. On Point is next.